Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 31 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, and hopefully all week, is the godfather of the Movies by Minute community, the current host, or one of the current co-hosts of the October Sky Minute. It's Jim O'Kane. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. You do the deepest of deep dives.
That's the way we're supposed to. That's what I learned from the best. That's the way you're supposed to do, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
Or are you saying that I learned it improperly?
No. You do it way. You do it with more aplomb and éclat than I do. Definitely. You're in the nitty gritty of stuff. I'm usually fumbling around, but no, this is always a great. You do some of the best deep diving. I think it's there are pearl divers in the Pacific that are envious. Well,
coming from you, that means a lot. So I appreciate that. So minute 31 begins with Zeus letting us see his tonsils, and ends with John explaining his plan in a way that doesn't really explain things. So we ended things on Friday. John and Zeus took a little stroll through Central Park at time travel speeds, and. You know, they as the minute was ending on Friday, they were about to leave the park by, you know, using a rock as a ramp. And today's minute begins with the end of that, where it just starts off with Zeus screaming. You know, even in the subtitles, there's nothing. It's just screaming.
Yeah.
You know, and we get to see the taxi launch into the air, and then the taxi lands on the road and somehow miraculously, you know, it doesn't hit anything, doesn't hit any of the cars, doesn't hit any people. I mean, that's only something that happened in movies. In real life, they would have hit somebody at that point, and or the shocks of the car would have just broken as it made its landing.
Yeah, that ship, you know, wasn't going to go anywhere after that jump. It was
no, not at all. And they land on what we can see. We can see the street signs. It's 7th Avenue and West Drive, which is basically Central West, you know, Central Park West.
Yeah. Or yeah, what would be 59th Street would be that if it weren't called Central Park South, or they're coming out at the south end of Central Park, which is that whole street there. Way down the end, you'll see the GM building. And then to the right, of course, the famous Plaza Hotel, and the big flag we see there is the New York Athletic Club, which has been there since just after the Civil War. It's one of the oldest athletic clubs in America, I think. And you know, very very famous ritzy part of town. I mean, the Ritz isn't there, but it's when you're next door to the Plaza, it's definitely upscale.
That's true.
So many things in movies happened right there. I mean, the two that come to mind is Jack Lemmon mugging Sylvester Stallone in The Prisoner of Second Avenue. He hadn't realized that he thought that Sylvester Stallone, who looked rather thuggish, had stolen his wallet, and he beats up Sylvester Stallone and grabs his wallet, goes home, and finds out that he accidentally mugged a guy without realizing it. I think another more familiar one would be that's where Giselle and Robert from Enchanted start their walk through the park right there. Of course, this would have been a lot different movie if there was musicals and synchronized singing and dancing.
For sure. But they're also close to the Dakota.
Yeah, that's right. The Dakota's only up there on 72nd Street. One of the most famous scenes right there is where Cary Grant is accosted by two henchmen of James Mason in Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. That happened. Right.
Didn't someone do a minute movies by minute podcast about that? I seem to recall.
Yeah, somebody must have. I'm sure there's a deep dive out there that we could look up. But yeah, definitely one of my more favorite scenes there.
You didn't have that scene though, did you?
No, I didn't do that one. I forget who did that particular one. And you know, it's funny, Cary Grant at the time lived at the Plaza. He had a regular hotel room there that he basically lived in when he was in New York. And so it was very familiar territory to him, especially. And what he liked about it the most was he didn't really have to commute long when he was on set, just to take the elevator. But right.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And just for anybody who didn't get the plug, what we're basically saying there was is that you know, Jim was producer of numerous Movies by Minute group projects, and one of them was North by Northwest. If I remember correctly, you did it four or five years ago.
That's right. Yes, it's part of it. It's still available, hopefully, at HitchcockMinute.com. Or you can find it on Spotify and all those other, wherever you're finding this particular podcast. If you spin around the dial, you can probably find ours too.
Right. And I mean, we get to see that John is just completely in a hurry. He keeps speeding along in the taxi for obvious reasons. And then Zeus turns to him, and I've never caught this line before. I've never paid attention to it, but you know, when you do it this deep, you know, and you pay attention to all of the subtitles and you're checking to see what's going on. And Zeus says to him, how do Catholics do their things? And John responds, north, south, west, east.
That's an interesting way of thinking of the directions of doing things. It's you know, as a guest Catholic here, it's a symbolism that's been used in the Catholic Church, symbolizing the shape of a cross on one's body. It's been around for almost as long as Catholicism's been around. Historically, Roman Catholics do it north, south, west, east, as John points it out. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, I don't know if you're crossing a date line or something, but it's done the other way. It's north, south, east, west, basically across your forehead, the middle of your torso, your left shoulder and your right shoulder if you're Roman Catholic, and right shoulder, left shoulder if you're Eastern Orthodox.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Have you ever seen the movie Keeping the Faith with Ben Stiller and Edward Norton?
No, I have not seen that.
Okay, so that's a movie about a rabbi and a priest who are like best friends.
Oh.
And through part of it, they talk about the fact that you know, they're trying to help each other learn about the other one's religion, and you know, so Brian, you know, played by Edward Norton, is trying to explain the whole thing of how you remember. You know, how to do the cross, you know, and he basically says, spectacles, testicles, wallet, watch.
Wallet and watch. That's the more familiar one that us kids who went to Catholic school heard. Spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch. Although the reach is
in
not
Catholic school, they told you that.
Other Catholic kids, other Catholic boys would mention that. But yeah,
okay, that actually shocked me that's what the teachers would explain.
Yeah, no, right? I can't picture Sister Ruth Eleanor telling me that in catechism school. But yeah, no, and the reach is not that low on the second part. You only have to go down to about your the bottom of your sternum is probably about the easiest way to remember that part. But yeah,
mm-hmm. Right. Well, if we really want to get into it, we can always get in touch with Father David and ask him how that works.
I think you can. Yeah, and he might be he would probably be one of the first ones to bring up the spectacles, testicles part.
Probably.
Yeah, it's not in Catholic theology. It's not as strong as, say, a Jewish mitzvah. It's known as a sacramental. It's something that it doesn't make you any holier, but kind of puts you in focus with your relationship with God. So that's where it's at. There's nothing particularly magical about it or anything, unless you're in the, you know, like an exorcist movie. But it's just generally, it's kind of like, it is kind of like putting on your glasses and making yourself focus to what, you know, the situation that you're in.
So what would be the reason that you, I mean, obviously I've only seen it in movies, but you know, when someone's about to die, they make the sign of the cross in front of them.
Exactly. That, and that would be, you're focusing on, well, maybe not this life, but the next life is what it's generally thinking of. You're focusing on prayer, and you're judging your relationship with God at that moment. Some people look at it as, I mean, it can have like a, some people treat it like a voodoo element, like you're warding off evil and things like that. But generally, it's, if you can imagine, I'm using outdated outdated analogies, but it's like the dial tone for starting a prayer. You're getting,
what's a dial tone?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, how do I explain it? You can't even say, it's like, you know, when the modem goes bee, you know, it's like that. But yeah, it's a beginning and an ending. It's kind of like picking up the phone and hanging up the phone. That's where that motion is generally supposed to represent. And this scene reminds me that I don't know if we've ever seen Samuel L. Jackson afraid in any other movie. I mean, I keep rolling through, what other things has he been in?
Been afraid?
Yeah.
That's actually interesting. Yeah, good point. Because even in movies where he's just in like small scenes and then he gets killed, like in True Romance or something like that, you know, he's happy right before he gets shot. So it's like he's not scared. Maybe in Kong Skull Island when he's about to die, maybe he's a little scared. Maybe.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Was he afraid in Unbreakable or Glass or any of the, you know, the M. Night Shyamalan?
Unbreakable, he definitely was not afraid.
Yeah, not afraid, yeah.
Glass? No, I don't think so either, because he you know, he thought that this was inevitable. You know, everything that's going on.
Certainly not Pulp Fiction. This could be one of the this could be the rare Samuel Jackson's afraid of something.
It could be.
Even when he
especially since he right away he actually crosses himself as soon as John tells him that, which again I never noticed. You know, you're not looking at Samuel, you're not looking at Zeus. You're looking at John, and you're looking at what's going on the road around him. You know, so it's great. I always love in movies, like even going back to the famous scene in Star Wars, you know, where you don't notice the stormtrooper hitting his head until you notice it. And once you notice it, you can't not notice it.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll always,
because it's something that's slightly out of focus, but once you know it's there, it's there.
Yeah. I mean, it's you'll never forget Samuel L. Jackson blessing himself in this
that's right.
Scene. So, but it's interesting that he suddenly got religion through blasting through Central Park, and it's all over right now. I mean, it's like this is the part where it's over. Now he's back on the street. I'd be more worried up when he's blasting through the trees and stuff.
No, but maybe it was because they were just, you know, going towards the atmosphere, and that was what hit him.
Yeah,
you know, forget about the fact that they were missing people along the way all last week. But you know, I guess once they had the jump. You know, from the rock, maybe that was what really jarred him, because he's like, oh my God, I can't believe I just made it through that.
I don't know. It was very, very unusual. Wow. But he's, anyway, they're all relatively safe and sound now that they've made it through the rocks and trees. But yeah. They've landed in, a very familiar part of town for me, Columbus Circle right there, in the middle of a traffic jam. And we get to see, a really big part of Lost New York that I remember quite well from the 60s and 70s, the New York Coliseum. You can see on the other side of that Columbus, the statue of Christopher Columbus in the center of Columbus Circle, there's a big gray wall. And I don't know how many times as a kid I used to go to the New York Auto Show. And I think there were a couple of science fiction shows that I went to in the early 70s there. But that was always like the big barn in the middle of Manhattan, where you could go and see a bunch of different oddball conventions.
And right before he gets there, so you know, John says to Zeus, he goes, how much time? And Zeus looks at his watch and goes, 27 minutes. And then John goes, ha, 72nd Broadway to Central Park South in 3 minutes. That's gotta be a fucking record.
that's definitely a John McTiernan wrote this moment. Like, sure, you can do that in 3 minutes.
Yeah, but I mean, it's great that John is already sobered up from everything that's happened, you know, throughout the course of this morning. Yeah. You know, and he's basically already saying to himself, all right, hey, look, you know, he's giving himself a clap on the back that he was able to break some record. You know, it's done really well. Do you think that's in the script or not?
The impression that I got from watching, well, the original Die Hard was that McTiernan doesn't really ad lib much. He might change slightly, but yeah, it could be a bit of ad lib there, a bit of, or like they shot it one way and then thought, well, let's try some more. And I think McTiernan probably had a couple of choices for him when when they did the final cut. And we know that this movie has been cut several different ways as time went on. So yes. It might be just yes. He all decided, right, well, let's go
we'll
that
find
way.
Out. We'll find yeah. out shortly. Find shortly when we get to the script. and John, then they end up getting into the traffic jam, as you said, and John goes, come on, get out. And then Zeus looks and goes, yeah, now what? And then they sit there for a few seconds, and then Zeus goes, you know what? We need a fire truck. John goes, what? He goes, to follow. And then you can see, like, the light bulb over John's head as this happens. And he, you know, his mind is always racing, and he decides, okay, he knows what he's doing. He takes the CB, changes to channel 9, and then we hear someone say 911, and he goes, Lieutenant John McClane, NYPD, access number 7479, calling from a civilian transmitter. Get me an emergency dispatcher right away. And then literally within a second, we hear, dispatch, go ahead, which is pretty impressive that they're able to switch him over that quickly to a dispatcher.
Yeah, especially. You
know, it's credit for that.
And CBs don't work that way. So it was a bit of a...
In this world, they do.
Yes, in Die Hard world, they do. Yeah, this is like watching, right, you know, Grand Theft Auto or something. It's just a little bit off. But it's okay. It works for John McClane, so it'll work for us.
That's right. That's right. And then, so he says, dispatch, go ahead. And John then screams into it and goes, I got two officers down at the corner of 14th Street and 9th Avenue. Need an ambulance. Over. And then he looks to Zeus and goes, emergency calls on the west side, go to Roosevelt Hospital. That's two blocks from here. And then we see him, like, turn the wheel and get ready to leave the traffic that they're in. And I was going to talk about Roosevelt Hospital now, but I think I'm going to wait until tomorrow because it's a little more relevant to discuss it tomorrow than to talk about it today.
Sure. No, that's fine. We can at least talk about where they're heading. I mean, the hospital, we know he wants to get behind somebody, obviously. I mean, that's what he's calling in. And that's what he said. We need a fire truck, but he'll use an ambulance instead. But the hospital that he's referring to is over on 9th Avenue. And when, you know, it's funny, in my head, when I remembered this movie, I thought they were chasing an ambulance later on down Broadway, but it hits me, that's not the way to go. That's, you can't, he'd wind up in Midtown, and he knows Manhattan traffic. So what he wants to do is get west and get on 9th.
That's right.
And then head down 9th, which is, and you know, it's funny, as we're going to be talking about this week, I that was the thing that had a change in my brain. It was some kind of like Mandela effect. I'm like, that he's not headed down Broadway. He's head, because they kept mentioning Broadway all the time, but he's actually heading down 9th Avenue. That's why he has to right. jump through all those fruit stands and things while his buddies are getting left in the dust of Columbus Circle.
Right. Well, we actually see we see the street signs that he's at the corner of 14th Street and 9th Avenue. So, you know, he geographically they're placing him in the right place, which is nice. You know, they took care to, you know, close off all these streets in the middle of the day so yeah. that you know, they could have all these stunt drivers there to deal with the crazy John McClane driving.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to figure that out, how they manage this, because that, as you know, Columbus Circle is a hub, literally a hub in Manhattan of Midtown. It's the north end of Midtown. And I can't imagine any time of day, especially they were filming this in the fall, so they had to wait till, you know, the sun was high in the sky. This is all bright daytime. And it doesn't look like they've recreated it, you know, in some other town and built Columbus Circle somewhere else. So they had to, the traffic control on this must have been incredible, trying to get everything blocked off and rerouted out of Columbus Circle.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my assumption is they probably did this like on the weekend. They probably did it like on a Saturday or something like that, where there might be a little less traffic.
Yeah, that could be, yeah, like a Saturday or Sunday.
Well, Sunday, yeah. I don't know if it would have less traffic, because Sunday, you know, that's when people are all showing up in.
Are they at Columbus Circle or not?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just it's very peculiar watching all this. Do you know if there's a behind the scenes for this film? The DVD that I have only has the trailer, and they didn't have anything. There were no extras, but it's a very old DVD, so I don't know if there's somebody else did a behind the scenes somewhere.
I don't have one. I didn't see one, but that doesn't mean that there isn't one out there. I think I've told the story before, but I have an acquaintance, can't even call him a friend, who was living in New York at the time that they were filming this movie, and he was once walking down the street, and you know, he saw that they're filming a movie, and then he turns to some guy sitting in a car and asks him what the time was, and it turns out it was Bruce Willis, who just started laughing at the fact that this, you know, this random guy just asked him what the time was, not realizing it was Bruce Willis.
Wow, that's amazing. It's a hell of a town, as they say in the song.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. So, did you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
Let me see. No, that's pretty much. At this point, I'm sure you've covered this in a previous week, but. As we're doing this, most of this week is going to involve Bruce Willis driving the cab at high speed through Midtown, and yes. I was surprised to find out that he wasn't, well, I mean, obviously he wasn't driving the car, but I thought that the car was on like a tow, that it was being either pushed or pulled by another car, but apparently there was an extra steering wheel in the back seat, and the driver was down low watching a TV screen of what was coming up ahead, and he was actually like driving while laying on his back. So
which makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious. But you know, I was thinking that you'd have a camera truck behind him, and the taxi would be bolted on the front of the camera truck. But it's, you know, it sure beats having rear projection and stuff. This is, it feels very tactile, for lack of a better term. But yeah, this is a.
Those were the days
before green screen.
That's right. I mean, it also was a very, if looking at everything that happened last week and looking at what happens this week, they had a lot of stuntmen that needed to be on the scene to be doing all this driving there and seeing everything that happens. So, you know, it's in some ways it's in your face the way that they do it. But I mean, it's great because, you know, even just talking about the little, you know, scene at the beginning of this minute where the car is flying and it lands, you know, having to coordinate all of that stuff beforehand, you know, to make sure that there's no car that's going to be in the way and stuff like that is just, it always amazes me about how much preparation goes into making a scene like this, or even just moments of a scene.
And you read about like the production was something like a little bit over 40 days, that you could fit all this in a couple of weeks. And you think, oh, hopefully there's no rain. Hopefully there's no, you know, there's a transit strike or something. We can fit all this in the middle of, September, October, and get it all done and not have to do many reshoots. It's phenomenal. But I guess, you know, this is McTiernan coming back to a familiar ground, action movie. So by then he probably had all of his ducks in a row and knew, you know, get this done, get these permits finished, find people we know who can help us close off Columbus Circle for a day, and then just roll in one night.
Well, you think, set up you think they were able to do all this in one day?
No, I'm you think I'm they were saying
able to do this well, all in one day.
I don't think it was all in one day, but I think, you know, being able to get it shot, I would think they would have to pull it down to a minimum and say, yeah, you know, okay, we're going to get as much as we can in Columbus Circle, and then we're going to move, you know, moving on. And so I'm sure the specific Columbus Circle part was all done in a day. I would think that. It's been, you know, the chase scenes probably lasted weeks.
Right.
It's just amazing. I'm always amazed at the organization behind that, being able to organize all that, so many moving parts, so much equipment, not just, you know, not just the cameras and the lights and things like that, but trying to set up the air cannons to shoot cars up in the air and all that other stuff. You know, even that opening scene with Bond with Teller, just trying to arrange the permits to have them shut down the street where there's, you know, there's stores, there's businesses, and all those people can't go in their buildings for that part of the day while they're shooting. Right. So it a lot of pre-planning that impresses me. The logistics, I think, is should get it. There should be an Oscar for logistics, and this would probably carry it.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, again, it's just mind blowing just thinking about that's someone's job. You know, their job is to make sure that they, you know, that they place every one of these cars, every one of these, you know, people, everything has to be perfectly placed in order to make sure that nothing happens that shouldn't happen in these types of situations.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
Yeah, it really is. But like you said, nowadays they do that less because they use special effects. But, you know, I've always preferred... In these type of movies, I prefer practical effects as opposed to special effects. Obviously, if you're talking about science fiction and stuff like that, then you can't do everything with practical effects.
It's really something.
Especially since nowadays they mostly don't.
Yeah,
that's what it comes down to. Right. All right. So the script is a little different. So it starts off with, it says, McClane grips the wheel with white knuckles. Zeus is having a coronary. The taxi smashes through the wooden, now entering the throughway, fishtailing through the jogging lane and sliding headlong into traffic. McClane then says, okay, there's Central Park South. How much time left? Zeus looks at his wristwatch. 27 minutes. 7-second Broadway to Central Park South in 3 minutes during rush hour? Gotta be a record. McClane looks at Zeus. He glares back. McClane floors it. Central Park South. The taxi flies out of Central Park onto 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas, and runs straight into an impenetrable wall of traffic. Everything has come to a dull, painful crawl. McClane scans the avenue. I was afraid of this. Midtown at rush hour's murder. We need a fire truck. I don't see any fires. To follow. Gotcha. Done deal. McClane clicks on the CB, adjusts the van. NYPD, may I help you? This is Lieutenant John McClane, NYPD Access ID 7479, calling from a civilian transmitter. Give me an emergency dispatcher. It pauses. We hear a phone ringing. Then, 911, what's your emergency? Two officers down at the corner of 14th Street and 9th Avenue. We need an ambulance. This is an emergency. McClane slams down the radio and jerks the wheel, banging a right on 57th Street. He turns to Zeus. Emergency calls us on the west side of Manhattan. Go to Roosevelt Hospital, which happens to be two blocks away. What do you know? You're good at math? Well, I'm good at this. McClane guns it. The car flies down 57th Street. So whatever. I think they did it much better in the movie as opposed to the way they do it in the script. But it has some nice flow to it.
You know, yeah. You can feel the tone in the script. I mean, it's easy to picture, even if it comes out a little different on the screen. But I guess that's a result sometimes of just more takes, and then picking the best for him.
Exactly. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called McTiernan Monday, where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan films. Now, as I've talked about over the last 7 weeks, there's pretty much only 11 to choose from. So it might make it a little easier, but that means that, you know, you actually have to have seen five.
Wow. Well, yeah, I do have my five, and Mostly I was trying, I think the problem on McTiernan is like, which one do I like better? Do I like this better, more than that, or this, you know, and it's, I did a lot of shuffling when I was writing down. I could think of a bunch right off the bat. And I know that the shocking one that people will not follow along with me is I do not have Predator in my top five.
Okay.
I understand people who enjoy Predator. Predator did not thrill me. I was impressed by the effects. Some of the acting was good, but it just, I felt like I was at a Universal thrill ride, and it just didn't get for me. But I'll give you my five, starting with number five.
Then I have to ask the question. Okay, of the 11 movies, so how far down is Predator then? Because you got Rollerball.
It might be six. It might be six. I would say
that. Okay. All right. It's not that just, far away.
Honorable mention. I'll put that at honorable mention. And I know that there's a lot of people that be like, what do you mean you don't love Predator? And it's like, Predator's okay. It's a perfectly fine movie. I just, if I were flipping through channels and Predator came up, I don't think I would stop. I've seen it. Okay. I've watched it, and that's where it is. Thomas Crown Affair is my number five. It was a very adequate remake of the original, the 68 Steve McQueen movie. I thought Rene Russo was a little bit weak in it, but Pierce Brosnan did a very adequate job. I love heist films. I mean, McTiernan is a master of a heist film. And
especially when you have the Gruber brothers involved.
Yeah. So it's just, it's very, the opening scene in it where there's, with the Trojan horse, that's the exact plot of what was going on in the very first Batman television show episode with the Riddler, only it was an elephant instead of a horse. So it was like, I don't know if McTiernan caught that, but it was like, yeah, that's perfect. But yeah, I enjoyed Thomas Crown. It's one of those ones that you don't, there's movies that when you're sitting down to watch a movie, you might get up and get some popcorn. And it's like, this one is like, well, what happens next? Well, what happens next? Well, and I don't get up for popcorn when I'm watching Thomas Crown. So that would be my number five. Number four would be Medicine Man. I enjoyed Medicine Man simply because I'm an old guy and I relate to it a lot more and more as time goes by, because Sean Connery finds basically a cure for cancer, and then he forgets where he put it. He lost the cure for cancer, and it has some really good, I mean, a lot of meaty acting chops to do in there. I thought the interplay with him in it, you could almost do it as a stage play. I mean, it really wasn't. It wasn't set with a lot of, I mean, there's action, but a lot of it is just talking. And I like this. McTiernan has a really good job in doing dialogue, as we're seeing in this movie. He has a good way of, with a couple of sentences, you get the idea of who these people are. You know, it's like, you know who Lorraine Bracco's character is, you know who Sean Connery's character is, and their interplay, they're very abrasive to each other, but they eventually have they come to a détente, and then it turns into, like, you know, a romance. But I like the way he understands people. The people act like people, and Medicine Man, I think, is one of his most people-oriented movies. So I'd put that on my number four. Number three, of course, to me is Die Hard. Die Hard is a disaster movie that's flipped upside down. It's just a great story. It started the flip the script idea. You're seeing terrorism, but it turns into a heist. Everything is not what it seems. I think it's the movie that made Bruce Willis. I know people point to Moonlighting, but Bruce Willis was made in Die Hard. He became the big box office star because of the original Die Hard. Alan Rickman, you can't replace him. I mean, Jeremy Irons does a good job playing his brother, but gosh, there's nothing like the original. And all the cast of henchmen, All the things that we talked about in Die Hard Minute on my show, and you did in your show.
That's so, right.
I think we both covered that adequately, that we both enjoy the film. And I don't think we would have done it, either of us would have done it, if we didn't absolutely love that film. So correct. I put Die Hard at number three. I think the mood, the critique of this film is changing. When it first was out, when it first was being sold, a lot of people didn't like it because they thought it was just too silly. But I really enjoyed Last Action Hero. Last Action Hero, my number two film. I love seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger make fun of himself. It's such a great, he gets to play literally against himself, the real Arnold yeah. Schwarzenegger versus the movie Arnold Schwarzenegger. He takes apart I know they did Loaded Weapon and things like that, which was a satire, but this was a satire of a satire that, you know, he opens up his closet and he always has just the same outfit. And there's like 20 t-shirts. You know, he's always that way. The kid who knows all the rules of what happens in an action movie, and when he suddenly realizes that he's the comic sidekick and then he's gonna get hurt in the next scene. Schwarzenegger's character Jack Slater knowing that in the real world in Manhattan, he knows that his Taurus has airbags and uses them against his attackers. Little things like playing the Max von Sydow part from The Seventh Seal coming out of a movie and mm-hmm. trying to figure out reality. It was such a perfect opportunity for McTiernan to explore all these other genres. And this also captures the magic of going into a theater. I mean, everybody has that feeling when you're going to sit down that the characters just jump out of the screen at you, that you're part of it. You're totally,
and this movie literally.
Yeah, quite. And, you know, and it's like I remember those ratty old theaters on Times Square before it got the renovation and stuff like that. I had been inside the Paramount when it was pretty much abandoned, and it was just, you know, you could smell the moss growing under the seats. It was just an old place. And it's that pre-renovated Times Square look that I don't miss, but I miss. I remember the griminess, the gritty, you know, if you watch the opening of Shaft or if you watch Midnight Cowboy and stuff like that, that's what the gritty 42nd Street Times Square look of the place was. I identify strongly with that kid because that was me in the, you know, in the 70s jumping over to Manhattan and tootling around places where I wasn't supposed to be. But it's a very close number two. Actually, it was really running neck and neck with my number one, which of course is Hunt for Red October. I love Hunt for Red October. Alec Baldwin creates the Jack Ryan character on screen. It feels so real. It feels so in touch with its material. The Navy acts like the Navy. The CIA acts like the CIA. Everybody there, you know, you feel the tension. You feel it feels like, you know, it's not a spy thriller, but it's a thriller where there's bad guys you didn't really, you know, you don't realize who the bad guys are. And are there bad guys? You know, it's like who's going to be the mole in this situation? And, putting Tim Curry in a submarine. Who would ever thought you'd see a movie like that? So, he was great. All the characters are great in there. You just, you know, just sitting and watching Sean Connery at his Conneriest. it's such an enjoyable. I may watch this movie again tonight because just thinking about it makes me wanna watch the movie. But I'm going on a trip tomorrow, so I can't stay up late. I can't do that, but I want to watch Red October one more time just to get it in my system. But it's always with you. If you have your Amazon Prime with you, you can just carry it and watch it on your iPad somewhere.
There you go.
Wow.
Let your wife drive and you can see Red October on the way.
Go to that. And, you know, it's Sam Neill without all the dinosaurs. So
that's right.
I like, but yeah, those are my five.
All right, great. So, Jim, would you like to tell people where they can find Jim O'Kane these days?
Well, these days you can find me out on a show we're doing right now about the 1999 Joe Johnston film October Sky. And of course, we're doing it movies by minute style. We go through every minute of the film. We have a guest list that I can't. I lose my breath thinking about the people we've had on. We have director Joe Johnston. We've got screenwriter Lewis Kollek. We've got producer Larry Franco. We've got Academy Award winning actor Chris Cooper. We've got Elia Baskin, who people even remember from 2010. We've got the wonderful Natalie Cannaday, who plays Homer Hickam's mom in the movie. And we're still working on Jake Gyllenhaal and Laura Dern. They haven't said no yet, so I'm still holding out for them. But and we even have the subject of this film, Homer Hickam Jr. himself, is part of our show and is an honored guest on many episodes. So please, if you get a chance, October Sky Minute. It's also available at OctoberSkyMinute.com.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you feel like you want to send me an email, you can send me an email to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Johnny comes marching home again. Hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.